So number 10 is in the book. I don't think many people have that book. There's one. We have one. Nice. You have one. Oh, we're all set. Edith, you want to read the first? Well, it's so short.
Number 10.
Number 10? Okay. Just read the whole thing.
The Buddha said, "Subhuti, what do you think? Did the Tathagata obtain any such dharma in the presence of Dipankara Tathagata, the Arhan, the fully enlightened one?" Subhuti replied, "No, indeed, Bhagavan. The Tathagata did not obtain any such dharma in the presence of Dipankara Tathagata, the Arhan, the fully enlightened one." The Buddha said, "Subhuti, if any bodhisattva should thus claim, 'I shall bring about the transformation of the world,' such a claim would be untrue." "And how so?" "The transformation of a world, Subhuti, the transformation of a world is said by the Tathagata to be no transformation. Thus it is called the transformation of a world. Therefore, Subhuti, fearless bodhisattvas should thus give birth to a thought that is not attached, and not give birth to a thought attached to anything. They should not give birth to a thought attached to a sight, nor should they give birth to a thought attached to a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, or a dharma. Subhuti, imagine a person with an immense, perfect body whose self-existence is like that of Mount Sumeru. What do you think, Subhuti? Would such self-existence be great?" Subhuti replied, "Great indeed, Bhagavan. Such self-existence would be great, Sugata. And why? Because self-existence, Bhagavan, self-existence is said by the Tathagata to be no existence. Thus is it called self-existence. Because, Bhagavan, it is neither existence nor no existence. Thus it is called self-existence."
All the way through, Red Pine gives the a title to this, or finds a title to it given by some ancient teacher. And this one is called by Chao Ming, the ancient teacher, "Transformation of a Pure Land." Weineng says, "A pure land is where pure thoughts arise. The transformation of what is external is no transformation. Thus follows a chapter on the transformation of a pure land." So this is about bodhisattva attainment. The attainment that is no attainment, what it is to be a bodhisattva. And it starts out with Dipankara. Dipankara Tathagata was a Buddha way, way before Shakyamuni Buddha. And he was... arriving in a town, and as he arrived in town, another Buddha arrived, and he wanted to show his respect for this Buddha, and so he lay down, and he had long, long hair, and laid his hair out across a mud puddle so that this Buddha could walk across the mud puddle. And that was considered to be a kind of turning point in those Buddhas, the Buddha after Buddha after Buddha through centuries and centuries, millennia. That is one of the turning points that from which our Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, was supposed to have come. So that was a very big deal that he he is often thought of as having obtained a great merit for having done that. And so Subhuti is asking, you know, what happened? What was transformed? He must have done something really special. And Subhuti replies, Buddha is suggesting that that's what he thinks. And Subhuti replies, no, the Tathagata did not obtain any such dharma in the presence of Dipankara. So then Buddha goes on, if any bodhisattva should claim, I shall bring about the transformation of a world, such a claim would be untrue. I will come and transform the world. The transformation of a world, Subhuti, is said by the Tathagata to be no transformation. Thus it's called transformation of a world. So the arhats, or arhan it says here, the practicers who practice so hard for enlightenment are practicing in order to leave, to transform themselves into another land, to change worlds. And Buddha is saying, this is about Buddha saying, we stay here as bodhisattvas. We're not going anywhere. Buddha himself was persuaded to stay after his enlightenment. Somebody will understand. A few people will understand this, and you must share what you have experienced. So, so it took a long, long time for this whole thing to come to fruition. Kalpas of preparation, Red Pine said. Lots and lots of work. So Subhuti is saying that the Dharma needs a teacher, but it doesn't contain anything that one learns. This is a really important point. The Dharma of the Tathagata is like the sunlight. It shines everywhere but cannot be grasped. That's Huineng. The Dharma needs a teacher to explain, but does not itself contain anything that one learns. Yishun said, some people think that if a person becomes a Buddha, the world is purified. This is a great misunderstanding. Buddhas and the beings they teach together complete the perfection and transformation of a world. This is something that our own life and culture is, in the last years, few years, beginning to understand better. That the truth of our life is not only an individual life peeking out of a little hole into the world, but it's also a world that we are a part of, which is alive between two people. The life of our world is between each other of us. Buddhas and the beings they teach together complete the perfection and transformation of a world. Buddha said, who would purify their world first purifies their mind. As their mind becomes pure, their world becomes pure. We don't have much control over a lot that happens to us, happens to the world around us. But we certainly can pay attention to our mind and train our mind in all the ways that we long for. Often we think it should be easier than it is, but it's not so easy. I think we're still learning how to be human, still learning how to use this thinker that we have up here, still learning how to understand it, the whole system that is this mind-body breath system. They're asking really intense and interesting questions now about it in ways that sound like we're beginning to understand. But the best we can do is stay as awake as we can, be as aware as possible of how we're feeling, where we are, and to be honest and clear about those things, to be willing to express the life that we call me. It takes courage. Bodhisattvas are great, courageous beings, willing to take on this impossible task of staying here, being here with everyone, not trying to transcend and go away forever. Actually, it's impossible. There's no going away. And that was this Mahayana discovery. In the Perfection of Wisdom, it says that Tathagata is not attached to anything because his mind does not seek to rest on anything. He is not attached to the created, and he is not attached to the uncreated. It's easy to think, well, I'm done with this part. I'll go to this other way. And he's saying, any kind of attachment gets in our way. It creates a big misperception about who we are and where we are. As soon as we're attached, even to the Dharma, even to Buddha, then we turn ourselves and our world into a thing, a manipulable thing. And the life goes out of it, the light goes out of it, which is always changing, coming and going continually. Red Pine said, not only do bodhisattvas transform the world, they transform their own existence. The same cannot be said of arhats, who renounce their self-existence as well as the possibility of future rebirths or future bodies, and thus the means to liberate others. And yet, despite their transformed existence, bodhisattvas are not attached to their existence, for every existence is no existence. We talk about self and no self, and dropping the self, dropping body and mind. The self that's not a self, the self that is not a fixed self, a self that is something different every moment, the self that is obviously different every year, and even more obviously every 10 or 20 or 30 years. Looking back through all the photographs, we see how we've transformed over and over. And so our minds transform as well. Constantly changing. So transforming the world is transforming oneself and one's relationship to the world. How we see it and be it. And accept it. Allow it. And don't flee. Manjushri once asked the Buddha, what constitutes a great body? And the Bhagavan answered, what is no body? That's a great body. It includes all pure teachings of morality, meditation, and wisdom. Thus it is called a great body. This true body also refers to the true mind. And the true mind can swallow Mount Sumeru. Like that little puzzle that is given sometimes, how sitting here on this side of the river, how can I get over to the other side without getting wet? Of course, we think our way over there. We can easily be there. So this wonderful image of Mount Sumeru being like a person with an immense perfect body whose self-existence is like Mount Sumeru. And Subhuti says it is great because self-existence, Bhagavan, self-existence is said by the Tathagata to be no existence. Thus it's called self-existence, because it's neither existence nor no existence. Thus it's called self-existence. So as you can tell all through here, we also are facing the mystery and magicalness of our greatest power, which is the power of language. Trying to express what can't be said, using the clumsiness of our language that is the best that we have to express. Although the Mahayana story of our practice as distinguished from other Buddhist practices is that when Buddha wanted to transmit to his students, he held up a flower and didn't say anything. And his students, one of them smiled. And Buddha felt what was between them and agreed that he was the one. So we admit that we really can't say. And yet this is this kind of dialogue this kind of paradoxical language is pointing to just exactly that. How we're tied to language and attached to language, and yet we have to let go of it in order to move on and to understand what there is to know. And so we make the effort and speak as best we can and let it go. Many of the stories are about getting too attached to the words, like the fellow who got so attached to the Diamond Sutra that he could recite it backward and forward, but he didn't really understand what was in it, what it said, till he met somebody. And then he burned up all his papers. It's a painful paradox sometimes, because we need words so badly, and we need to express so deeply. And yet, if we talk too much, we ruin it. Or it feels like we're undermining something, or putting ourselves in the way of something that's too big to say. So the image of Mount Sumeru is a pretty good one, a pure, perfect, beautiful body. You could say that's the universe. That's our world. That's how it is. Thus, it is called self-existence, because it's not existence or non-existence. You can't say. So we trick ourselves as we try to feel our way along. So, are there questions?
I just wanted to ask, I'm so interested in that story of Deepankara, and the former, I don't know if you would say it was a former incarnation, putting his hair down.
Yeah.
But there was no, the point was there was no merit in that. Or there was nothing attained, or...
Yes, there was nothing attained. How does the Buddha say it? Yeah, did he obtain any such dharma? And the such dharma is the self-existence, I think, of that mighty, beautiful self-existence. That having done this incredible thing, that nothing was attained. Yeah.
And yet, it was, if you think of all of his lifetimes, it was a step on his path.
It was, and an important one. Yeah.
So it seems like a paradox.
It is. Yeah. Well, it's two sides. There are always two sides. Right?
Let us say that Shakyamuni previously Deepankara is the
bishop. Yeah, he was previously Deepankara. There are many, many, in fact, in our lineage chart, we name five of them, I think.
Yeah. What about Amitabha?
That's a cousin, I think, or something. Mm-hmm. Amitabha is the Pure Land Buddha.
Yeah, I know. Well, you mentioned the Pure Land, but I don't think I'm not 100% sure whether it's connected with this.
I see.
Mention of the Pure Land, and maybe we will see the practices.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Lives in this Pure Land, sometimes somewhere in the West. Very popular in China and Japan.
Yes.
But I think that I have read that they say a lot of the practices of some of the practices of the there's a lot of back and forth. And
yes. Yes, much. Much, much of it. Yeah. Well, I often talk about Pure Land practice and Zen practice as being two sides of something. It seems to me it has to be like that. That's the two sides again. The side that simply throws yourself on the mercy of Buddha and don't try anything. Trust your life and trust your Buddha. And then there's Zen, where we march in and splunk ourselves down and say we are going to sit, we are going to do this practice. And if we practice very long, we get very humble and realize that there's a big surrender that has to happen. And I think Pure Land people, if they practice and if truly honest about their humble practice, that they become stronger, as strong as Zen people are when they come in and sit down, so that we meet somewhere in the middle with not as much arrogance as we start out with, and without as much groveling as they start out with. And that somehow there's a clear, pure place in the middle where both practices become one.
What about other practices?
Oh, I don't know. There are lots and lots of them. As Ron says, they are all mushed together, much more than we've ever thought in the beginning days of Buddhism in America. We thought there was...
We were just talking about Buddhism.
Yes, yes, right. But there are many different ways. After all these thousands of years, it's natural. It just does change. Well, it's 8:00. That went fast. I want to pass these out to you all. Thank you. Thank you. So fearless bodhisattvas give birth to a thought not attached to anything. Fearless bodhisattvas. And he goes on, I think, in the next chapter to talk about how scary this really can be if you take this seriously. And how liberating.